Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location. Today, our guest in the second part of our program is Professor Gerald Epstein. The topic, putting the real American economy and the so-called economic recovery into perspective. You've heard me say many times on this program that I challenge the economists and the financial reporters at the different networks and in the media to justify the actual unemployment numbers. And they all continue to sing from the same hymnal, 3.6% unemployment. No, it's 22%. How could you be off by over 700%? And if they are, I'll offer that same challenge today, Professor Epstein, because he is professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and co-director of the university's Political Economy Research Institute. So that'll be an interesting discussion. Then I'm going to do a essay. This is a part of our ongoing commentary series. This is the next segment in the environment. And this was motivated by an editorial in Yes Magazine, a very good magazine, by David Corton, who's optimistic about the future. So I took a careful look at his arguments, and for the first time, I put forward my own. And you can have a chance to agree or disagree in part or whole, but I'm going to be dealing with that today. So now, I don't think I'll have time to address two of the listeners yesterday, because we got a packed show. But if I do, I will. I'll address the one where it was suggested that the lesser two evil is still better than what we have. And then better defining the linguistics around who comes to the United States as an immigrant or a person seeking asylum seeker. These are all different topics, people impacted for different reasons, and I have a discussion on that as well. I'm also going to set aside one entire program from beginning to end for people to call in and share their points of view on important social issues. That'll be coming up in the next 5 days. But we always start every day with the latest on health and healing. It'll be just a little bit of abbreviated program on this because I want to get so much in. University of East Anglia says in an article published in Nature Communications that climate change is posing a threat to male fertility. The new findings are showing that these heat waves are damaging sperm in insects with negative impact for fertility across generations. And the research team says that male infertility during heat waves can help to explain why climate change is having such an impact on species populations, including climate-related extinctions in recent years. So that's important, because what are the birds supposed to eat if the insects are gone? And then now we see with the global warming and the warming of the oceans, those mammals that are living there are not able to have the krill and other food that's their supply. They're dying of starvation. In fact, there's an area the size of Scotland in the Arabian Sea that is a dead zone. A dead zone, by the way, and there are over 400 dead zones. The United States has its own. In fact, I didn't have a high-resolution camera for drone photography when I was originally filming in the Mississippi. Now I do. So I'm going to revisit there in the next couple of weeks. Because you've got a dead zone at the base of the Mississippi as large as the state of New Jersey and growing. What it means is this. Because of our reliance upon phosphate-based fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers, instead of doing proper soil management by growing green plants over the winter, such as soybeans, organic soybeans, and then in the spring, you plow them under. That then replenishes the nitrogen in the soil that would otherwise be depleted if you left it barren. So they just loaded up with chemicals, and those chemicals washed into estuaries and creeks and streams and rivers, the Mississippi and the Missouri, ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. There it causes algae blooms. Algae sucks all of the oxygen out of the surrounding water. Then the fish start to die by the thousands, hundred thousands, then millions, then hundreds of millions of fish. Mammals have a rough time. Now, mammals come up for breath, and, you know, so they're not as susceptible, depending upon the pH of the water. If it's highly acidic, they too can die, as evidenced by the red algae blooms going from the shore about 40 miles out, now surrounding most of Florida. So everything has to live in balance. Everything. For those of you who attended a retreat I did recently, about a month ago, the key emphasis in every lecture was balance. Not a balance between that which is constructive and destructive, positive and negative, healthy and unhealthy. That's not balance. Balance is the best that you have been with the best that you could be. Between those two is where you have balance. And any time you live out of balance, you pay a price. You just don't know what the price will be and when it's going to be delivered to you. And I've seen it in my own family, the people that would smoke 3 to 4 pack cigarettes a day and laugh at you when you said that it was bad for you. Well, it's not bad for me until their heart attack or lung cancer, and then it was. So when you think, oh, gee whiz, we don't have mosquitoes, then what are bats supposed to eat? Now, bats can eat a lot of mosquitoes. But what happens when they don't have anything to eat? At least those bats that have to, not all bats eat mosquitoes. Some eat fruits. But we are running out of insects. That is not a cool thing. More on that in an upcoming program. But they're just now finally figuring out why. And mind you, heat waves cause damage across generations. And so it's just not the current insects, it's generations of insects. Recently I was asked about this new EPA in the omega-3 fatty acids, and it's a drug. Much like resveratrol, people spent millions of dollars, some scientists, to patent what ostensibly was a natural product. You could get it if you ate grapes or drank grape juice, or to a lesser degree, substantially less, if you drank red wine. So the headline was that natural omega-3s don't help you, but this drug does. It's extremely misleading because the release of the data from the clinical trial does show, to its benefit, an increased cardiovascular risk of taking statin therapy, which I'm opposed to because statin drugs are a fraud. And the trial led by investigators at Brigham and Women's Hospital had found that a drug developed by Amarin Corporation is a pure, stable form of the omega-3 fatty acid known as EPA. And that, in turn, was shown to reduce the risk of death due to cardiovascular causes and heart attack and stroke in that population. And the main results of the reduction of cardiovascular events sponsored by the pharmaceutical company. So you have a pharmaceutical company that's doing the research, setting up the design, and then publishing the results. What could possibly go wrong as far as conflict of interest? And then they published it in the New England Journal of Medicine, which quite frankly today means nothing. So here's what you got to understand. If you look at the average person's intake of the omega-3 fatty acids, more often than not, it's very low. In fact, the amount of vitamin C in most supplements is very low. And so when you say, well, you can get your vitamins from your food, minerals, it's simply not true. We are a nation living with so many diseases, and many of these diseases are subclinical, meaning they're not classical, scurvy, but it's right above the classical scurvy. In fact, I know this for a fact because we worked on thousands upon thousands of patients, the whole medical team, for 15 years at the Tri-State Healing Center. And there with cancer, we would sometimes see 200,000 milligrams a day, per day, 5 days a week before we could reach threshold and spill it into the urn. Those people recovered, remarkably so. Now, could you imagine if they took 100 milligrams of vitamin C and asked their doctor, "Doctor, I heard more. What if I took 200 milligrams?" "Oh, that's nonsense. Now you're taking a lot of vitamin with no proof." No, there was abundant proof on high dose. So if you're taking enough of the DHA fraction, the omega-3, which is really the protective fraction, oh, you're fine. You can get it from avocados and walnuts and flaxseed. But if you're trying to sell people that your patented, high-priced synthetic drug is better, then you use as case histories that people are taking an insufficient amount. So let them do another study. I'll give them 100 people who are taking high doses of what I would consider normal amounts of omega-3 fatty acids, between 3,000 to 5,000 milligrams a day, predominant in the DHA, and let them compare it to their drug. Then let's see if they get an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. So for those of you using the omega-3 fatty acids in its natural form is what I recommend, I believe you're clearly on the right side of protecting your heart, your triglycerides, your cholesterol, and your blood pressure. Good for you. Also, there is a direct link now between pesticide levels in expectant mothers and autism risk in their infants. This is from both Columbia University and the University of Turku, which is in Finland. Now, science has provided more clues as to why autism rates in children continue to skyrocket throughout the Western world. And a groundbreaking new study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry found that pesticide exposure in pregnant women is directly correlated to increased autism risk in children, pointing to industrial agriculture as a major cause of brain damage in exposed children. A team of researchers from both Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York City joined up with researchers from the University of Turku and the National Institutes of Health and Welfare, both in Finland, to take a closer look at whether or not pesticides, and specifically DDT, play any role at all in causing autism. And using data collected from the Finnish prenatal study of autism, they found that, yes, indeed, there is a correlation. And in fact, what they discovered is that a child's risk of developing autism is roughly 33% higher when the mothers have elevated levels of DDE in their blood, and the risk jumps about double, the team found, when DDE levels are detected in the top 75th percentile, suggesting a corollary relationship. Will anything happen because of this? Absolutely positively not. Why? Because our EPA long ago was captured by special interest groups. It was captured during the Clinton era, the Obama era, the Bush era, and of course now under Trump. So we just have to be aware that it's there and go for organic and keep our kids away from pesticides. Another study finds turmeric and curcumin to be a safe and effective treatment for lowering cholesterol and protecting your heart. This was done at Chongqing Medical University in China. And taking curcumin, cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, and turmeric. And by the way, I don't believe you have to take turmeric because curcumin comes from turmeric, but it's a very small percentage. So you have to use a ton of turmeric to get any kind of curcumin. So I have found the benefits come just directly from curcumin, and the higher the dose, the better. And these have positive impacts on your heart. Why? Because they lower lipids, and that's important. So, and this was, again, all these are published in peer-reviewed medical journals, and done. This was a nutrition journal. Now, I've mentioned carnosine, C-A-R-N-O-S-I-N-E, carnosine. New research shows it protects your pancreatic beta cells and islets against oxidative stress damage. This is from the Institute of Cancer Research in Italy. And according to this reporting in Palmero, the islet transportation is a valid therapeutic option for type 1 diabetes treatment. However, in this procedure, one of the major problems is the oxidative stress produced during pancreatic islet isolation. So in comes decarnosine, and it helps eliminate oxidative stress. Now, L-carnosine is the form you take it, but then it's the isomer of decarnosine that actually is doing it in your blood. So more good reason to take your L-carnosine every day. And finally, how fast you walk says a lot about your health. This is according to University of Southern California. So during a doctor's appointment, there's a few measures that quickly get a physician up to speed on your current health, such as measuring your blood pressure, checking your BMI, which is your body mass index, how much belly fat you have. But researchers say it could be helpful to add one more indicator, and that is measuring how fast you walk. And a really strong predictor of your lifespan is the speed at which you walk. The faster you walk, the better it is. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So fast walking, power walking, even race walking, all does you good. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Our guest in about 15 minutes, and later today on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we're going to have Professor Eileen Christina Piva. She was on last week, and she was so good, and I felt we had needed a lot more knowledge from her. So we're going to talk about neo-fascism in Brazil and the U.S. Western neoliberal and imperial agenda for Latin and Central America and the Caribbean. And she is very knowledgeable, and she is a professor in international law at the University of Venezuela. So that'll be a conversation at 7 o'clock tonight on PRN.fm. You won't want to miss that. Now we're going to take a moment and share some thoughts. I've been doing a series of articles with Richard Gale on the subject of our environment. This one is called Global Warming, We're Screwed. There's no longer any question that climate change and global warming are bearing down upon us more aggressively and rapidly than previously believed. It is wishful thinking to cling to fantasies that life will return to normal. Reports on approaching climate change tipping points become dire. It is also the truth today from all of science that climate change is real. However, we should prepare ourselves for what can be done in our own lives and communities and learn to adapt to the new abnormal that has never been experienced since Homo sapiens appeared during the Middle Paleolithic period 200,000 years ago. Since 1972, we have been warned about the impasse we are now reaching. 46 years ago, the Club of Rome commissioned a consortium of scientists and legislators and corporate leaders and economists to create the now famous Limits of Growth Report. That report predicted a systematic collapse of human civilization due to obscene economic growth and the depletion of essential natural resources. But leaders throughout the developing world flatly denied its conclusions, as did those in the first world nations. It should therefore be evident that believing our world's leaders will act in unison to lessen climate change's forward advances is both idealistic and impractical. And while there is a 97% consensus among scientists globally that planetary warming is human-generated, only 15% of Americans, according to a Yale and George Mason University survey, know and understand this fact. The Trump administration and the remainder of the American population continue to embrace the fallacy that the scientific community is divided on the matter. They are not. We now have the most anti-rational government in U.S. history, one which categorically refuses to grasp the larger picture and instead chooses to assail the environment to leverage short-term gains and profits. Clearly, the message is not being communicated, and this leaves millions of citizens in harm's way as climate change worsens. We can identify several different attitudes about humanity's ability to tackle the accelerating challenges of climate change and global warming. The question I pose is whether it is possible, or even reasonable, to hold two seemingly diametrically opposed positions simultaneously. I believe it is. One view holds that technology will save us, full stop. Such a utopian outlook is ultimately paralyzing because of the massive sums of money required to implement the new world-saving technologies. Some regions can benefit, of course. Ultra-wealthy Gulf states like Qatar and United Arab Emirates, for example, can afford to build the fantastically expensive desalinization plants along their coastlines that are required to turn desert expanses into arable land. But at $100 million minimum apiece, these plants are firmly out of the reach of 99% of the planet's population. Other nations must therefore set their sights dramatically lower. And here the gap between what is needed and what technology is capable of becomes problematic. Some environmental groups insist we merely need more wind and solar energy. And in spite of the high cost of building wind farms, and by the way, we did an analysis in my office. We actually took an average wind-generated appliance and looked at how much steel was in it and all the electronics and how much each one of these contributed to global warming, and we found that even though there are 15,000 of these deserted around the United States because they no longer function, that we never recover the cost to the climate in recapturing carbon that went into making them in the first place. In essence, we didn't stop and ask ourselves, in order to stop global warming or lessen it by implementing these wind farms, what is the cost to the environment of making them? And the cost that we actually contribute to polluting the environment and creating global warming is greater than what we get in return from the final product. Just some poor thought went into this. But again, a lot of people don't look at the dead birds. They don't look at the unlivable noise, the blighting of a whole countryside. Hydroelectric dams are a much more economically sound model for alternative energy. But you have to have a river that has enough velocity to, in other words, create this, and that's a prerequisite. Some groups of environmentalists, believe it or not, are even embracing full-scale nuclear power, claiming it is non-polluting. They ignore or forget or disingenuously avoid discussing how enriching uranium creates tons of pollution, how there is no safe disposal process for the spent fuel rods that will remain radioactive for eons, how nuclear power plants are prone to accidents and meltdowns, particularly as catastrophic climate events become more frequent, as Fukushima continues to remind us. For the techno-utopian set, These are the Silicon Valley wunderkinds and the best and brightest on Wall Street. The solutions are always just beyond our fingertips. And we're supposed to merely prepare for the arrival of our techno-saviors by thinking positively about the future. The leaders of this school of thought are the masters of positive platitudes. And nothing, not facts, not science, or cold-hearted reality will intrude upon their fantasies. Now, David Corton, writing for Yes Magazine, asks us to believe that it is within modern civilization's power to wake up and make the critical changes necessary to either lessen the impact of climate change or reverse its course. Corton is not alone, and I suspect most climate scientists and environmentalists agree with him. Thousands of scientists convene at climate conferences around the world to discuss their conviction that our political leaders and institutions will arrive at a moment of clarity just in time to launch a global Marshall Plan to save our planet and species. After the release of the 2018 International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC's report, arguing that limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius is achievable if drastic action is taken within a dozen years. They imagine there is still plenty of time to act together and thwart the worst consequences. This attitude is especially prevalent in the United States, a nation whose unrealistic optimism stems from its historical capacity to be industrious and innovative and brilliant in finding solutions historically. Now, although this overly idealistic attitude is not by any means utopian, it lacks a deeper understanding of the psychology of power and wealth and domination and hegemony, and in particular economics. The environmental crisis is intimately entwined with the economic crisis. It was Chris Hedges on this program who said, if hope is something expressed through illusion, it is not hope, it is fantasy. The greatest strategy rests on the idea that wise people from interdisciplinary fields will collectively unite and work together to slow down and, where possible, reverse deforestation and the acidification of the oceans. We can dramatically reduce industrial agricultural practices and wean ourselves away from our meat-centric food habits. And the technology is already available to rapidly convert to renewable energy sources. Within a reasonable time period, so it is believed, coal, nuclear, oil, and natural gas can be phased out and replaced with cleaner geothermal, solar, wind, and wave technologies. This is a noble view. Its optimism offsets the otherwise growing sense of apathy, indifference, and fear that climate change instills in billions of people who are experiencing environmental catastrophes at this moment. I fully support those who embrace this optimism, such as David Corton and Michael Mann, Bill McKibben, and others. I want to believe that what they believe will come to pass. But there is a serious problem that nobody I'm aware of in the popular climate movement or among scientifically literate legislators have understood. That is, every movement requires an intelligentsia with the capacity to serve as policymakers and opinion leaders to answer the most crucial questions. There cannot be an orchestra without a conductor. It is not the case, as Marx would have us believe, that the masses of average people are capable of agitating and launching a revolution as gargantuan as a much-needed Marshall Plan for the climate. Such a grand strategy to tackle the demands of climate change has been discussed for decades, and yet the rush to extract and consume more fossil fuels, continue increasing global warming, has only increased itself. Consequently, the American presidents, including Clintons, Bushes, Reagans, Carters, Obamas, and Trump, prefer to follow the road of Hades by favoring the illusions of perpetual growth over human survival. We'll get to it, we're told, in time, and there's plenty of time. We're out of time. And no, we're not going to get to it. In order to mobilize the masses, scientifically committed and powerful inspirers must step forward and take up multilateral leadership positions. As long as the powers that we value short-term gain over long-term survival, there can be and will be no meaningful change on a societal level. On the other hand, there's another growing faction of people whose awareness has expanded beyond the desire of self-gratification and acquisition of power and wealth and possessions. Their attitude is pragmatic, yet cautiously optimistic. They are not policymakers, and their efforts are never going to make headline news. This is the new civilized, literate segment of humanity who are going off the grid and moving to sustainable regions in sustainable communities. Their conscience is aligned with the changing times and planetary needs. They are saving seeds. They are growing food hydroponically. They're building berm houses. They're doing what science and common sense and history has shown us will allow a person to survive. They realize that the overuse of land to feed America's hunger for a meat-based diet is contributing dramatically to climate change. And they understand that going vegan cuts their carbon footprint by almost 80%. Princeton University calculated that the animal-based American diets accounts for 85% of all agricultural greenhouse gas emissions and wastes about 90% of arable land that could otherwise feed an increasing population more efficiently and nutritiously with the plant-based foods. Unfortunately, multiple industries and the entire banking and investment sector benefit tremendously from economic growth within the livestock and commercial food production industries. The new climate hierarchy has efforts that will not allow any of the tipping points to stay untipped. They will simply look the other way because they're making money. And as a result, we, the people all over this planet, will be impacted with chaotically cascading degradation. For that to commence, a worldwide effort is necessary, and there's no chance that will happen. Just take a look around. Who will lead it? The President of the United States, the President of France, the President of Saudi Arabia, or the ruler of Saudi Arabia? Which president? The President, new President of Brazil, with the largest rainforest in the world? No, he's privatizing and destroy that rainforest. Ours is a functional illiterate. I mean, Alfred E. Newman would be up 10 points on this one. And so we have no major leaders. Theresa May? No. No, it's not going to happen because we're not looking at who the policymakers are and opinion leaders. And the third attitude is best exemplified by scientists willing to speak out about the worst-case scenarios, such as Paul Beckwith, Kevin Hester, Guy McPherson, Natalie Sakova, and the anonymous climate scientist blogging under the pseudonym Sam Karina at Arctic News. These are the messengers of despair with only flickers of hope. There are already too many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to make any discernible corrections. Humanity has waited far too long, and unfortunately, and I regret to say, it is far past time when nations are capable of mustering the necessary resources and collective will to do anything truly constructive. Remember, no matter how articulate, well-mannered, nicely dressed, the platitudes flowing like an eel going through butter, it doesn't change a damn thing. But it makes people look like they're doing something if they show up and speak nicely about what we could do. Scientists such as McPherson are not advocating complete apathy, nor suggesting that we retreat into a stupor of do-nothingness. Nor is this small contention of Cassandra's saying we will experience an apocalyptic end to the world. Rather, they encourage us to understand that half the climate tipping points have already tipped. I know 42 tipping points. I know which ones have tipped. When was the last time any media, mainstream or alternative, discussed tipping points, explained what they were, and the positive feedback loops where one tips and it causes another to tip, and what that means for us? Can you mention a single media? Which one? Isn't that important to know? I think so. Evidently, it's not in their news cycle. It's not in their politics of ignorance. So here we are. Instead of encouraging us to understand what a tipping point is and why they've already tipped, their message was much too harsh, McPherson's and others, when it was first introduced for most of the population and none of the media to swallow. And as a result, they mostly disappeared off the radar, their positions not renewed, their books unpublished. Yet they told us the truth that we are unprepared to act on, that we have to stop blindly spending, that growth for growth's sake is unsustainable and ultimately self-destructive. How is a society to digest such messages when its entire economy is based upon an accumulation of stuff? But these are the pragmatists, and their message is very simple. Educate yourself, change your habits, network with like-minded people and communities, and realize not everyone will have a place in the lifeboat. And finally, there is the attitude of the climate change deniers who will discover the lifeboats have been filled when their personal Katrina moment arrives. Professional climate change deniers, almost none of whom are climatologists or experts in anything related to atmospheric sciences or the environment, have generated about 200 arguments on why we should not be worried about global warming. Almost none of these opinionated views are based upon peer-reviewed scientific publications, and the few that are can contradict themselves and are amateurishly thought out. One of the stupidest relies on the theory called equilibrium climate sensitivity to debunk a relationship between CO2 release and temperature increases on the Earth's surface. Grammar school physics can deconstruct the theory because the theory completely ignores that when water gets warmer, it evaporates, thus increasing the greenhouse effect. And the enormous illiteracy among large segments of the American population is indulged by its media echo chamber, the chorus of illusionaries at Fox, InfoWorlds, Breitbart, the Trumposphere, and the evangelical Christian networks, telling them there's nothing to all this climate nonsense. Just keep performing the rituals and parroting the dogma of all those floods, fires, storms, droughts. We'll stay confined to the television where they belong. No one wants to believe that their home will be burned, flooded, desiccated, or otherwise destroyed. And these types simply choose not to do anything. They ignore the weekly reports of new climate disasters, hundreds, even dozens of miles away, reasoning that if it's not happening to them, it's not their problem. Among these are found the evangelical Christians who believe God will save them at the last moment, whether via an emergency rapturing or a last-minute stilling of the roiling tides of an angry planet. They stand side by side with the Schadenfreude addicts, so blinded by the joy they feel in seeing others' misfortune and suffer that they cannot see that that misfortune is also their own. America is a nation of individualists who deep down might find it hard to stomach the notion that with regard to the environment, the human race stands or falls together. But we must get over our aversion to collective thinking quickly, unless we wish to sacrifice ourselves for a principle we don't fully understand and are not spiritually aligned to commit to. Aside from Americans being poorly educated about the climate change, the entire dominant edifice of corporations, government, and media is determined to keep everyone pacified and in denial. And this is largely due to an embedded elite that rule over the institutions responsible for altering citizens and preparing the nation for an uncertain future. The entire mainstream media has acted criminally by keeping Americans ignorant about climate change and the science supporting humans' responsibility for global warming's escalation. Media Matters reported that during 2018 heat waves, three major networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, only made reference to climate change in one of 127 segments, one time. For Fox, hurricanes devastating the Florida panhandle and the Carolinas, or California's 1.6 million acres ravaged by wildfires in 2018, had nothing more to do than an act of God. The reason for our media's denial is obvious. It is the same leaders of industry and government who optimize their position of power by making us feel that we are too illiterate to understand the problem. That is part one. Tomorrow, I will give you part two of Global Warming, We're Screwed. The optimist and utopian, the pessimist and the pragmatist, and the denialist and the apocalyptic. And the most important part of my message will be on tomorrow's show. Back in a moment with my guests. Please stay with us.
Baby, I'm yours. And I'll be yours until the stars fall from the sky.
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world for joining in. My guest from Massachusetts right now is Professor Gerald Epstein. I gave you his bio at the beginning of the program, but he is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and the co-director of the university's Political Economy Research Institute. He's published widely on issues related to macroeconomic policy to promote economic justice and sustainable solutions to enhance living standards. He's published on central banking in the international and U.S. financial systems. And he was a visiting professor at University of Rome, University of Paris, Senegal, China, Turkey. Holds degrees from Princeton University, where he has a doctorate, and also co-authored a textbook on the political economy of financial crisis and other works dealing with globalization, inflation, and monetary policy. His forthcoming book will be entitled The Political Economy of Central Banking, Contested Control and the Power of Finance. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm pleased you can be on the program this afternoon, and there are several important topics I'd like to have you to address. One, regardless of whether major media outlets are pro or anti-Trump, and Trump's exaggerations aside, we hear repeatedly that the nation is in a new boom cycle, a bull cycle. The gross domestic product growth rate, we are told, is between 3.5 and 4.1% during the past two fiscal quarters, which they say is very good. Everyone is praising job growth, and everyone is praising low unemployment. So whatever that actually means, and we could discuss that, consumer spending is rising. Neoliberals love that. Again, is this real cash spending or just added more debt to credit cards? Personal credit card debt is now over $1 trillion and rising. On top of that, there is $15 trillion of mortgage debt, $1.5 trillion of student debt, another $1.2 trillion of auto debt. And then I have to look at the national debt, which is $21 trillion, and the total U.S. debt is a whopping $71 trillion, and then ask, what kind of recovery is it really, because none of the economic metrics and growth statistics give any indication that to
Well, you really went through a whole litany of statistics, which certainly raise serious questions about our economy. The economic growth that we've experienced since Trump was elected is, first of all, very much bunched. The benefits are very much bunched at the very top. You know, the top 1% or less are getting most of the benefits. The growth is really a continuation, pretty much, of what was started under President Obama. And it's also, as you said, full of landmines strewn throughout in terms of increases in personal debt, consumers, students. And there's also a big ballooning of federal debt because of the huge tax cuts that the Republicans and Trump administrations passed.
What is disturbing to me is that this image of an economic recovery is being endorsed and supported by contingents that we might not expect such support for, like labor and trade unions. Many Democrats have even bought into Trump's political economic policies. Obviously, the banks and corporations love it, especially the military-industrial complex. But it's all based upon short-term profits. Nobody's looking at the larger picture in the future, especially the huge costs the federal and state governments will be facing with climate change and growing health care needs. What are all these people missing or in denial about?
Well, I think you're right. There is a denial in all quarters. And part of it is that people aren't continuing to pay attention to the longer-run problems that we have. The lack of investment in education and infrastructure, the ignoring of climate change, as you pointed out. So I think most people who look at the data carefully, and there's a very good article in the New York Times today, that I recommend, really points out that this is more like a sugar high. It's not a real structural change in the economy. Yes, we get some expansion because of the tax cuts, mostly that went to the wealthy. Profits are way up because the corporations got major tax cuts. They're mostly just giving it to their own shareholders, either in the form of dividends or stock buyback. There has not been much of a widespread increase in investment to create more jobs or higher wages for workers. At most, there have been a few increases in bonuses for some workers, but those aren't permanent. So, as you indicated in your discussion before about climate change, most pundits and many politicians are ignoring the truly deep underlying problems that we have. I am somewhat hopeful, though, that with the recent election, especially the change in the House of Representatives, the electing of a number of people who take climate change seriously, have put that on their agenda, I'm hopeful that we're going to hear more about climate change. Of course, whether it's enough or quickly enough is a whole other question.
You wrote a piece earlier on Trumponomics and indicated that what is different during the Trump administration is that his economic policy is part of a social movement, which is deeply tied in with right-wing nationalistic ideology. What you've called the Schacht theory, named after Hallmar Schacht, who was Hitler's economic advisor. Now, Hitler can be commended for boosting the German economy after the First World War and followed the Depression. But economic policy also led to the emergence of a political infrastructure that we now define as fascistic. What are the similarities that you have observed between the Nazi political economic policy and what the Trump economic team and the GOP is doing? And I don't want to suggest, and I will not suggest it, that any of this is necessarily intentional. I could just be given the idea that the Republicans have a strong sense of anti-democratic nationalism, an addiction to privatization and protectionism, this just happens to be the economic policy that is emerging. Nevertheless, I'd like to hear your analysis of the Trump economic policies, and in particular about huge tax breaks given to the largest corporations.
Right. Well, I wrote that article right after Trump was elected, and at that time I was very worried, and I still am, but I was very worried that that the Trump administration would implement certain kinds of policies that appeared to have short-run benefits for workers and unions and common people, so that they would be able to align those voters with the Trump policies. And I knew that Trump, like in previous administrations of I was worried about the analogy of Mussolini or Hitler, would clearly do a lot for business. So there would be this business alliance, but that the working class and the representatives of the working class, unions and so forth, would be tricked into supporting these kinds of policies because they would seem to be helpful and beneficial, but it would really just be solidifying the power of the right wing and the proto-fascists, and then those, of course, would come back to harm everybody. And to some extent, Trump did some of this, particularly with the tax cut and the way they've been trying to promote the tax cut, and has tried to do some of this with his trade policies, railing against NAFTA and so forth. My great fear was that the unions and the workers would take the bait and roundly support Trump in these initiatives. I will say that the success was not as great as I feared. That is, people have seen that the tax cuts aren't really helping most people. The way in which Trump implemented these trade restrictions has actually hurt a lot of workers, and they've started to see this. Some big business people who otherwise would have aligned with Trump are very concerned about the trade policies. So I don't think these policies have been as successful in solidifying the power of Trumpism, Trump and the neo-fascist components of his coalition, as I had feared. Now I think we're entering a new phase now with the Democrats in control of Congress. They're all talking about trying to promote more infrastructure spending, which is, of course, exactly what Schacht did with the highways and others to help solidify Hitler's popularity. The Democrats themselves are proposing some infrastructure spending. I was really opposed to going along with that when the Democrats had absolutely no power, because then it would all be a Trump-Republican show, and the Democrats and the workers would just be the chumps. Now, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think if the Democrats can propose real policies that help real working people and get the credit for it and get it structured in such a way that it's actually helpful for people in the economy, then these kinds of policies might make some sense. We'll see.
Trump is getting more applause for consistent unemployment growth figures than anything else, and the official unemployment is about 3.6%. 3.7%, and we're told that that's the lowest it's been in a long time, and for African Americans is 6.5%. However, when we examine carefully the actual unemployment figures, we're at 21 to 22%, and our math is simple. There are 210 million Americans of working age. That's between 15 and 64 years of age. 95% are out of the workforce. All right, 44% were retired, 14 million were in school or job training, 13 million taking care of a loved one, 15 million weren't working because of an illness or disability, and there's no number for how many out of work and willing to work but can't find work. So when you add in how many people could work, have worked, want to work, but no longer can find jobs, then that 3.7% unemployment is a farce. And why aren't economists and media challenging it? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that if you look at broader measures of unemployment, perhaps not going quite so far as you just mentioned, but looking at workers who have part-time jobs but want full-time jobs, workers who stopped looking for jobs even though they want them because they haven't been able to find them, the unemployment rate is certainly much higher than the 3.6%. Probably closer up into close to double digits for sure. I think I don't know why the media isn't really promoting this idea more. I think maybe it just seems too technical. And in fact, unemployment has come down substantially. The problem, of course, is that the wages that workers are getting is still very low. I mean, there's been very modest, if any, increase in real wages, that is, wages adjusted for inflation. Many of the jobs, though not all of them, that are being created are not living wage jobs. You know, unemployment is not necessarily the best measure of how households and families are doing. What really matters are in terms of just pure economics, is what their incomes and so forth. In addition, medical costs keep going up, housing costs keep going up. So I wouldn't say that most Americans feel a lot better than they did 5 years ago. So there has been some improvement in the economy, but it's been very unequally distributed. It's been very modest. And I think that we need to do a better job of making this clear to people what is really going on.
I would absolutely agree with that. Thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate you sharing your insights with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Professor Gerald Epstein, a professor of economics at University of Massachusetts in Amherst. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you and look forward to having you on board tonight, 7 o'clock PRN. Going to have a very interesting show about neo-fascism and neoliberalism together in Central and South America and the Caribbean. Have a nice day, everyone.